So then the other thing that I did is I sent a lot of cold emails, as you mentioned. And I mean, I wrote so many. And part of what I did is that I would, I'll give some tips for busy people. Email on the weekends. Like, don't email during the work week. If you, especially if you're not directly related to their work, it's like it's.
So, hi everyone, welcome to the podcast. So, today we're joined by Jimmy Sawney, an author of The Founders, and he's written some various other books as well. And he's a phenomenal person, somebody that I've really admired. And I've been trying to get him on the podcast since about, I think I messaged you back in like August. And now we finally made it happen in October. So, yeah, Jimmy. So, in an interview and a podcast, you meant I was doing some research on you, and in an interview and a podcast, you mentioned that you admire people who push the limit. So, who are some of these people for you in your life, or just like people that you've come across through your work as a founder and a writer and like whatever that you've been doing?
It's a great question. And honestly, I appreciate the persistence. Like you were I like that you followed up and you were like, I want to do this, and your enthusiasm was what, pushed me over the edge. Like, all right, she's sticking to it. And I think you're on some crazy time zone too. So I'd like we're not geographically anywhere near each other, and so it means all the more that you would do it. Let me think. It's a great question. Like, there are just so many different examples of people who push the limit, and I well, let me like take a step back. Why do I admire those people? Because when I'm writing books, they are very long, multi-year projects that have a lot of uncertainty, and you have to stick with them. And you have to stick with them in the face of rejection. You have to stick with them in the face of your own self-doubt. You have to stick with them in the face of just like getting bored. I mean, like, you can always like run into obstacles where you're just bored of a project and you have to find a way to get up and do it again. So I really like and look up to people who push the limit. I would say, let me give you a few examples just to get more concrete. There's a writer who wrote the book Seabiscuit, and she also wrote the book Unbroken. I really admire her. She suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, and she's one of these people that she's basically like overcome like this debilitating illness to write these extraordinary books. And there were times when, she'll give interviews where she talks about she was in her bed and she couldn't even move like the pages of a book. That's how tired she was. And I always think to myself, like, if she can do that work, I can do anything. There's a swimmer, a distance swimmer named Diana, I think it's Diane or Diana Nyad. She is the first person to ever swim from the coast of Florida to Cuba, something like that. And it was like an impossible feat. There are like sharks and like all these crazy things that are part of that journey. And she succeeded, I think, a few years ago. And I remember just listening to her on a podcast and thinking like how incredible it was, because there's no like Olympic gold medal at the end of something like that. She was just doing it to prove that it could be done. And that was really amazing to me. Like, that suggests, a lot of integrity. And then I would say that, one of the people that I admire, there's a great documentary about this guy Jiro. I don't know if he's still making sushi, but the documentary is Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And he has this sushi restaurant in a subway station in Japan. And the thing I admire there is, and people should watch the documentary, but because basically he's obsessed with making the world's most perfect sushi. And in this subway station, like in an underground, cramped, no windows subway station, but he makes what is, I guess, the world's best sushi. And his commitment to craft is really impressive. Like, the idea that he just continues every day, day after day, to get very, very good at this one very specific thing. I really admire people who are like that. And by the way, these people can be very weird. I know I'm weird, but to me, the idea of like devoting yourself fully to one thing over an extended period of time, like, has a lot of appeal, particularly in a digital era when everything is so quick and ephemeral and not very long lasting.
I think I learned a ton about some new people as well. There's some new people you put under my radar, like the swimmer and a few others. So my next question to you, so what motivates you to become energized, to get out of that rut, and like what motivates you to like start writing to start doing this? Like, who were your inspirations, like, to get into writing in the first place?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think most writers, at least most writers that I know, they start out writing because they became readers and like just became really obsessive readers and then just started like, yeah, there's like, it's very rare for me to meet a writer who isn't also a reader. I actually don't think I have a single friend who's a writer who's not also sort of an avid reader. And so for me, when I was young, I would just read all the time. Like the books that most motivated me early on, like there were series. There was like this series called the Mossflower or Matameo series that was by Brian Jacques. I loved those books when I was a kid. There's a series called Encyclopedia Brown. I read Garfield comics. I mean, I read anything I could get my hands on. I remember sitting at the breakfast table when I was little and in the morning before school, I would just read the back of the cereal box, or I would like read books. And I remember all my books had like food stains and like food crumbs in them, because that's how much I would just read all the time. And I just became obsessed with books. And then naturally kind of from there, you start to sort of think more critically about books. You think more critically about language. Then you decide, okay, I'm going to try my hand at this. So I wrote for my student newspapers. And then just kind of one thing led to the next. You see your name in print, you get really inspired. And then I started to think about like books as a thing I could do. And at the beginning, it was just, okay, why not? Let's try this. Let's see what happens. And then over time, I've obviously gotten better at it. I wouldn't say I'm where I want to be, but I've gotten better at it. And my books have earned some acclaim. What motivates me now is, I think, different than what motivated me when I was starting my career. What motivates me now is I like finding stories that no one else has told in book-length form and then telling them. I like discovering those little gems, the little kind of like something that someone forgot. So there's now like a big empty space on a bookshelf where there should be a book and no one has written it. And for me, like filling that space on that shelf, it like can get me up every morning with a ton of energy, because I know how much the books that I have read meant to me and how much of an impact they had on my life. And I kind of think that, look, if I'm putting these things out in the world, like that could do that for somebody else. But then also I just like it. Like I just like the process of years of research on one specific topic.
Yeah. So let's riff a bit on that. Like what was your process and your research behind your book, The Founder? So I know you did an extensive amount of research on to come up with The Founder's book. You interviewed like some of the top people at PayPal. So how did you go about getting access to those interviews and the amazing people in PayPal? And how do you structure cold emails? So I saw in an interview that you said you'd sent out like a bunch of cold emails to try and get some of these interviews to happen. You got some intros as well to some of these amazing people. So like, how did all that transpire? And like, what could you share, some actionable tips or like some practical advice or like anything that you could share for the audience today on any of those?
Sure. So just to take a step back for listeners who might not be familiar with the book or with my work, my most recent book was called The Founders. It was the origin story of PayPal. Now, you probably know the company PayPal. Maybe you know the company Venmo. During PayPal's founding years, 1998 to 2002, they had an extraordinary collection of talent come together to build the company. Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, Max Levchin, David Sachs, the founders of YouTube, founders of LinkedIn, Palantir, all these amazing companies that kind of typify the modern digital era and the modern technology landscape, many of their founders or first investors came out of PayPal. What I found interesting is that, you know, all these people are kind of wildly rich and famous, but nobody had gone back and actually said, wait, how did that happen? Like, how is it possible that like, you know, technology's dream team all ended up at one company at one time? That's absurd. Like, it's just like the odds of that are astronomical. And so I just started by a friend of mine knew Peter Thiel. And I sort of had this intuition. I said, you know, like if I can get a meeting with him through my friend and I can make a compelling pitch about why this book should exist, maybe he'll go for it. Like he's somebody that my impression of him at the time was he's somebody who like kind of likes when people have these ideas, like just ideas for media objects, right? Ideas for books. Like he's a big supporter of different ideas. So I was like, okay, let me try it. So I had my friend connect us, and then I ended up pitching him the idea. And I said, look, I think that while you're interesting today, I think some of the most interesting stuff that happened in your life and in the lives of these hundreds of people happened between the years 1998 to 2002. And I think there should be a book about that. And he was very gracious. And he was like, you know, he said at some point I wanted to write this book myself. Now I don't. So you should do it, and I'll help however I can. And the help I most needed was a couple of intros from him and some time to do some interviews, which is exactly what we did. So what happened is that I would use like every new intro, I would try to get an intro to somebody else. And so I would daisy chain these intros over 6 years to basically like, you know, make sure that I was respectful. Like here, let me give you the practical tip. Peter is inordinately busy. He's got a million things going on. If I asked him for 30 intros, that would be terrible because I'm then the person that's the most annoying person in his inbox. I think I only asked him to introduce me to 2 people total, and I interviewed like almost 300, right? So I very much like went to the thing of I'm only going to ever ask for 1 or 2 favors if needed, and then I can move on to the next person because busy people are busy. You know, like they just have too much going on for you to be the person that's clogging up their inbox that much. So then the other thing that I did is I sent a lot of cold emails, as you mentioned. And I mean, I wrote so many. And part of what I did is that I would, you know, I'll give some tips for busy people. Email on the weekends. Like, don't email during the work week. Especially if you're not directly related to their work, it's like, it's really tough. I mean, everybody's got so much in their inbox and they've got so much on their calendar and they've got so many commitments and life moves so fast. The best thing you can do is like email on a Saturday or email on a Sunday when there is less of that pressure and tension of the work week. Another tip is, you know, people use a lot of copy and paste cold emails. Like they'll copy paste. I never did that. I actually tried to write individual emails, even though it took more time, because I would look at, for example, like somebody's LinkedIn profile and I would see if I had any common connections. I would see if I knew somewhere they worked. I would like think about like, this person said this one time in an interview or something. Maybe I can like use that. I was very tailored about the emails I sent. And I think that's like, look, you can't do that for everything. But for a book like mine, it really paid off because I think people recognize like, look, he's doing his homework. He's not somebody that's just treating every human as another number on a list of PayPal alumni. And I think there's something to that, like really personalizing cold emails. And then the other thing I would say is like, get ready for rejection. You know, I had people tell me no. I had people not respond. I had people, that was like something I had to deal with. At the same time, I would always include my phone number and in the cold email. And you'd be surprised how many people would get my email and just call or text right away. So, you know, you sort of have to prepare yourself for both unexpected surprises that are good and some disappointments because you're trying to reach out to a lot of people and it's not always going to work out.
Yeah, I think one thing I've really learned and taken to heart this year is like to not be so afraid of rejection. Like I've gotten rejected like multiple times already. Like for my podcast, I've been trying to get people from like Grab and like I'm being way too ambitious with this podcast. So
I would say don't say you're too ambitious. Like ambition is good, right? One of the things that like I think we need more of is unvarnished ambition. You know, you have to be thoughtful and you have to be measured, but I don't think that you should stop trying to get to some of the people that you think are most interesting, because why not? Like, you know, like people, especially if you're doing a podcast, you know, it's an act of giving someone a platform to talk about their life, to talk about their work. I would not run away from being ambitious.
Thank you so much for those words. And so my next question is more along the lines of the tech mafia. So you've written an extensive deal about the PayPal tech mafia. And so a person from the Fuller community called JBL, he's very curious to know about a bit about the tech mafias that exist outside of the US. Like we see Flipkart and some of these other Indian companies are having their own kind of tech mafias that are doing very well. So like, if you have any insights on that, like, please do share like anything you could share on that front.
Yeah. You know, I should say that I spent all this time really focusing on what is known as the PayPal Mafia, which was a name that was given to these alumni in 2007, many, many years after most of them finished with their experience at PayPal. And the reason they were given the name is because they stayed in each other's lives. So let me tell the story just a little bit so people have context. Many people joined the company between 1998 and 2002. The company goes public in 2002. And at the end of 2002, many of the senior figures in the company leave. They don't want to be a part of a bigger company. The company's been acquired. They're like, we're good. We're going to go do something else. They end up investing in each other's success. They end up like kind of helping each other out. They will give seed capital for the next company. They'll hire each other. You know, many of the first employees at companies like Yelp and YouTube were just PayPal alumni who knew each other from the PayPal experience. Over time, as those second order companies became successful, there was this mythos kind of created around like the PayPal mafia. And so what happened is that because that term took off, and because all these people became, you know, wildly successful within tech and elsewhere, you had like a kind of an aspiration was created for the Flipkart mafia or the Revolut mafia or the Monzo mafia or the – I even heard about the vegan mafia in the United States, right? I mean, there's like all of these different mafias that got attached to these terms. And I will say like I didn't do deep dives into all of those. But there are a number of – I mean, if you're asking what are the common features, like one is that the alumni just stay in each other's lives, right? There's a kind of they work together. They invest with one another. I had the experience when I was interviewing PayPal people. I'll tell one story. I was interviewing somebody. His name is Luke Nosek. And I was at his home. We had a long chat, like a long chat. And at some point, I think it was three quarters of the way through, he gets a phone call. And – He had been very diligent. He wasn't looking at his phone during our chat, nothing like that, but he got a call. And he picks up the phone, he shows it to me, and it's Ken Howery. He had first intersected with Ken Howery 20 years before at PayPal. And so what he said to me is, look, Ken is still in my life all these years later. These are different kinds of friendships than any other friendships I have. And so I think that's like one of the key, almost stupidly simple principles is if you are a part of a company and it goes through some big event, a transaction, a sale, an IPO, anything, recognize that like your peers may end up being the people that you do that you do business with for the rest of your life. I had this person I interviewed, his name is Jason Portnoy, and I was interviewing Jason, and I remember we were at the end of the interview, and you know, it was a long interview, and a lot of these memories like they come back in waves, and at the end of it he said, "Whoa." He said, "I can't believe it, but basically everything in my life I can trace back to the decision to join PayPal, like my friends, my, you know, everything." And I think that's like a key principle is that there are plenty of companies where the people don't get together after, don't invest in each other's success. This group happened to do that. I mean, it doesn't mean that all the relationships are harmonious and everybody's best friends or anything like that, but it is the case that they all stayed in tech, became kind of co-investors, board members, advisors, fellow employees, co-founders, and that built this sort of mafia. But I also don't want to like oversell it. It's, you know, it's not like there's like some specific organization. It's just loose friendships and affiliations that were driven by this very intense 4-year professional period. I think that's the other part of it is that these people were working shoulder to shoulder so intensely during 1998 to 2002, and they were working in the middle of the dot-com bubble bursting. So the stakes felt very high, right? And like that the intimacy was very high because they were just putting so many hours into the company. And I think that accelerates bonding. It accelerates friendship, right? And so there's something about that that's a part of this too. I would say the other piece of it, and I don't know how, you know, it's one of these that like, it's important for people who are thinking about the younger generation of mafias to remember this took time, right? So the company goes public in 2002, but the PayPal mafia whole story doesn't really happen until 2007. And even like it took a while for even that to become a thing, right? You know, Elon is Elon today, but Elon was not Elon back then. He wasn't a household name. So if you are a part of what you think is like a small mafia, just recognize that like the law of compounding probably applies. It might take some time for your mafia to be world famous.
For sure. And Elon Musk is actually a really good example of somebody who's like building in public, leveraging X, leveraging his own platform, basically. So what do you think kind of contributed to his brand building and like how he became so famous and so well known and maybe even so loved by people around the world?
Yeah, Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, it's a great question. No one's actually ever asked me that question. And not in that way. So I don't have like a stock answer, which is probably a good thing. I think that one thing to appreciate is that Elon has always had a sense of putting himself and his work in public. You know, one of the things I did in the research for my book is I found the first moment that Elon and a company that he was a part of was mentioned in the press. And it was in the San Francisco Chronicle like a million years ago. And it was for a company that at the time, their product didn't even have a name. And he was still like, let's get the press release. You know, I could just even picture it. Like, let's get the press release. We've got to put something out before somebody takes our space. I think that that is not for everybody, right? Like, not everybody wants to host Saturday Night Live. Not everybody wants to build in public in that way. I think temperamentally, he is suited for it. I think he enjoys it. I would say that part of the appeal for at least among engineers that I interviewed or other people that I know who look up to him, I think part of the appeal is the scale of the challenges that he takes on. You know, he has not like if you think about the industries that he is working in, they are very expensive. They are highly regulated. There's a lot of risk. There's like actual physical risk to people, right? Cars and rockets and you know, Neuralink with like testing things in brain implants. I mean, there's like some real, these are big, profound, consequential challenges. This is not like some tiny little problem that he's slicing off a small piece of. I think as in any field of endeavor, people are attracted to those who take on the big challenges, the big, like, let's get a rocket to Mars, right? And when I interviewed people who were a part of PayPal, now you might say, hey, PayPal, that's not that big. Well, except that Elon's vision for PayPal was that it was going to change the rules of finance forever. He wanted to be the biggest financial institution on the planet. And when he was recruiting people, that's how he would sell what he thought the company could become. And I had a dozen people at least tell me, you know what was so inspiring was Elon saying, we're going to take on the big banks. We're going to crush them. We're going to be bigger than JP Morgan. And that was energy. It was energetic for people to hear that. And I think that's what people are drawn to, right? I mean, even in our lives, like you know among your friends, who are your friends who are tackling big, big challenges, let's say like big relatively. Maybe they're not launching rockets, but they're doing something big and interesting. We are naturally drawn to those people. And I think that's like part of the appeal. Now, look, he's also like, I know he's a controversial figure. I know not everybody likes him. But I think that there is something to be learned from his willingness to put himself out there, the willingness to take on the biggest challenges, you know, for in his field of endeavor. And I would say also, like, he hasn't stopped, you know, like he had enough money when he was in his 20s to stop, but he kept going. He kept working grueling weeks and months and years and kept, you know, risking everything he had on the next thing that he was going to do. And so there's power in just like endurance, like longevity, like just like trying again and again and again, as opposed to somebody who says, oh, like I've made $20 million. I'm good. I'm like cutting out from the world. I'm going to go. Nah, I'm being no disrespect, by the way. There are plenty of people who do that, are great people. But you ask the reason for the appeal. The reason for the appeal is because even in his mid-50s today, he's probably working harder than most 20-somethings are. And that's not normal. Normal CEOs do not sleep under their desks. Normal CEOs do not stay in the factory at all hours and on weekends. And I think that's part of the appeal, is that he breaks the stereotype of a CEO who wears a suit and only, you know, works like within circumscribed hours. And again, it's not for everybody. And I don't know that like it's something that I can handle necessarily, but I think that's part of the universal appeal.
I think you really did shed a new light to Elon Musk and really how he has built his brand, how he's building in public, and how he's really in the trenches and doing stuff that other founders may not be doing. And that's probably what's leading to his success. So just a quick one. So do share like how the audience can connect with you and like how they can reach you, pitch to you, or like what do you want to share with the audience? Now's your stage to share.
No, I appreciate that. Look, the easiest way is probably Twitter. I'm at X, Twitter X. I'm at Jimmy A. Soni, JimmyASoni. You can also probably find my email. It's on my website, just jimmysoni.com. And, you know, the best way to connect with me, honestly, is just to buy my books. Like, they're, I put a lot of myself into my books. They are where I do my thinking. They're where I invest my energy. They, you know, these books become almost, you know, it's like almost like they're like my kids, you know, like they're, you spend years of your life on them. You hope, you put them out in the world. You hope they do okay. And my friends will tell you when I'm working on a book, I'm actually a very hard person to be around because I'm so focused on the book itself. But I would say I love hearing from readers, especially on Twitter. It's fun to banter back and forth. I don't do it as much as I should. I'm not like the most active person there, in part because I'm just like, so focused on book projects. But that's probably the best way to connect with me. And I think that, like, you know, find me there and drop me a line. And be persistent, because you were. That worked out really well.
For sure, for sure. I think those are some real nuggets you've shared today on the podcast. So if you're listening to this podcast right now, I have an open opportunity to reach this audience. So if you want to reach college students and freshers interested in startups and venture capital, and just in terms of the demographics, the age of 18 to 22 is the highest age demographic, and India and US are the two largest country demographics of listeners for this podcast. Email me at bizpodruhi@gmail.com. So thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode, and hope you've learned something new.